This is the McKinsey Podcast, where we help you make sense out of our world's toughest business challenges.
Welcome to the new season. I'm Lucia Rahilly.
And I'm Roberta Fassaro.
The opening salvo on the communications for much of the return to work started with some presumption that the employer could dictate the terms. That was absurd. You just spent 15, 18 months having people work from their kitchen table, work from their bedroom while their kids are trying to do some schoolwork. Give me a break. I mean, talk about a basic violation.
That's Bill Schanninger. I spoke with Bill and Aaron Desmet, experts in talent and organizational health. We talked about the startling number of people quitting their jobs and what leaders need to do to retain their best people. Aaron and Bill, thanks so much for being here today. I'm just going to dive right in. Aaron, in our recent research, you have found that employers think that employees are leaving the workforce or are dissatisfied due to a bunch of different reasons: compensation, work-life balance, poor physical and emotional health. And what's interesting is the findings showed that while these issues mattered, there were other issues playing a significant role in driving this employee exodus that we're seeing. What were some of those issues that you found in the survey?
Do I feel valued by my organization? Do I feel valued and acknowledged by my manager? Do I feel a sense of belonging with my organization and my team? Am I part of a high-performing, trusting, open, caring team with teammates that I like to work with? Do I have potential for meaningful advancement in my career? Can I have flexibility and autonomy in my work schedule? And a lot of employers don't pay nearly enough attention to those things. And they're paying more attention to things like, am I paying people enough? And is this the best comp and benefits that we can offer relative to competitors? And we not only see that in terms of what employees say is important to them, which they say those are important, just not as important. We also see it with employees who, in fact, are not leaving for a better job. Many of them are leaving the job they're in without another job in hand. They are just leaving. They're burnt out and they're looking for inspiration, social connection, belonging. And they're, when they don't find it, they're just quitting.
On the flip side of the survey findings, we also see that about 60% of respondents say they aren't necessarily likely to quit. And you would think that that should be a point of comfort for business leaders and for managers. But actually, you guys say that that's not the case. Why should employers still be concerned about the 60% or so who say that they'll stay?
Many of the people in charge can't conceive of a situation where people would leave without another job in hand. But the workforce is saying, oh, no, I'll leave. And I think we're so not tuned in to the dynamic going on for the current employees, what matters to them most. They've just had 15, 18 months, depending on where they are, of working from home, many of them, where their worlds about parent, teacher, partner, caregiver, all those worlds have been smashed together. They've had all this intense time at home. And they're waking up and going, hey, wait, I got to go back to that? That just feels like a violation at this point, particularly if it comes from the top without asking. So I think the dynamic here is wonderful in that employers are being forced to reckon with the world they've created historically, what employees have just experienced, and now trying to say, what world are we going to create? And unfortunately for many of them, their initial responses around a return to, well, initially labeled return to work, now being labeled return to office, has been wanting. Because it's been almost a return to form of an assumption, well, of course, we'll just tell you when you show up. And I think it's been repudiated quite a bit. And so maybe a little bit of a let's hit pause and restart about how it is we're going to reengage the workforce.
If you can create the right thing, you can keep the people you have. Because many of them are running away. They're like, this is hard. I'm feeling burnt out. I'm feeling stressed. I'm feeling anxious. There's just more and more change and uncertainty. I want flexibility and autonomy and connection and belonging. And a lot of these people are saying, I want to connect in person with colleagues. I just don't want my boss to tell me your schedule is Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. And that's not working. I now have a life at home that I'm very invested in, they also have a different lifestyle. And they're looking for something more from their employers. And when they're not getting it, they just need a break. But the other aha is when people step out of the workforce and take a break, it adds to a labor shortage more broadly. If you have 40% attrition, which is phenomenally high, and if even half of those people don't take another similar job, you're going to find massive labor shortages across industries in those types of jobs. And just paying people more, while it might be table stakes, is by itself not sufficient.
When you really look at this, and what Aaron was just saying around people leaving without another job, they're leaving you. And that, you know, emotionally might be a little tough. It's so much easier to blame the employees and so much easier to blame the competitors.
Another thing employers get wrong, employers think that employees want the ability to work remotely and that there's some magic number of days per month or days per week that employees are looking for. If you ask employees what they want, they say, no, actually, I'm okay with you saying I need to be in the office however many days a week, as long as there's some logic to it. But I want flexibility to decide which days and which hours I come in. And again, this goes back to the conditions we've created. And understanding what is important to employees means you can turn it around and create an environment not only to keep the ones you have, but to start attracting other employees from other places who are also leaving their jobs, in many cases without another job in hand. And if they find something better, a lot of these folks aren't quitting because they don't want to work. In fact, some of them are starting up little side gigs just on their own as a passion project.
Record number of small business starts last year.
Exactly.
It's remarkable.
And they're saying, I can be my own boss. I can play a passion project. Now, if I could find this at an employer, I would do that. And this is, again, where there's this huge opportunity to shift from the great attrition to the great attraction.
How can business leaders make the environment that much more inviting and help people want to come back?
The opening salvo on the communications for much of the return to work started with some presumption that the employer could dictate the terms. That was absurd. You just spent 15, 18 months having people work from their kitchen table, work from their bedroom while their kids are trying to do some schoolwork. Give me a break. I mean, talk about a basic violation, right? You know, when the people feel like they're not being treated like a person, it starts feeling transactional. Sometimes I think even, let's say, the really pro-employee views also don't make a little sense. Having the employee decide every day on when they come in, that may not also make sense. You know, if the work dictates an intense amount of collaboration up front, it should be okay to say, hey, we got to scrum here, guys, and it's probably going to be 7 to 10 days of getting this together until we get it up and running, and then we can back off. I think people would accept that. I think figuring out, look at the unit of work. Is it individual contributor? Is it small team? Or is it department? Like, what's the fighting force, if you will, and solve for that? I mean, we heard people talking about hoteling and having people come in and go, well, if the team needs to do the work, you should hotel for the team, not the individual. Otherwise, you just see people coming in and hot desking all around the place. They're not being there on a day. What good is it? There's no doubt there's a give and a get to this. At its core, it's an exchange. You know, it's a relationship. They would have done better to come out with some understanding that it is still a little crazy. You know, so long as you have employees who have kids who need to go to daycare, kids who need to go to school, or elder care that needs to be sorted out, if there's even a sniff that those things might close up again, they've got to know it's okay to call time and go back to doing what they're doing. And anything that comes out like a monolith and goes, thou shalt, I think they're going to walk away from it.
How much does geography play a part in job satisfaction or in this notion of, you know, the great attrition and the people running away from the workforce?
Even as people are coming into the workforce and saying, I'm likely to work for more employers over the course of my career, they're also saying, I'm likely to move from one city to the next for an employer less often. So what does that tell you? That tells you people are picking where they want to live, the communities they want to live, where they have friends, where they want to raise a family. And they're saying, I'm going to live here. And if my employer doesn't let me live where I want to live, I will find a new employer. That was pre-pandemic. Now with the pandemic, you have people showing that they can work remotely and be reasonably productive. You have teams that have formed that are much more agnostic of geography, without any clear expectation of travel.
Does this moment in time require a new set of leadership competencies to kind of create more empathy or create more of this relational environment for employees?
If we try to manage to how much output or activity, like how many emails did you write? Is it better to write 20 emails or 10? Well, 20 is twice as much as 10. If you're creating a presentation, 20 pages is twice as much as 10 pages. And I think all of us would say, if you can get higher quality of information with less words and less output, that's better. What we care is what functionality is delivered, what better user experience is delivered, what results are delivered in the code you write. And if you can deliver the same user experience and functionality and features and results and impact with half the amount of code, that's better. But the only way to do that is to shift your mindset to, I need to manage results. I need to manage to impact and outcomes and results, not to activities. What if they're goofing off? It's like, well, what if you really manage to outcomes and impact and results, you don't care how they spend their time. You want to see the results. And you don't need to look over their shoulder and see that they're typing an email.
Just on this thing around the leader behavior, trust more. Don't be a jerk. Don't think that you get to impose your will because you're afraid. Actually treat the people like equal humans, not as subordinates that you get to control.
Leaders are also humans, and they also are going through anxiety, uncertainty, grief, fatigue, burnout. They are likely to have fared better than most. They will have the agency, the autonomy, and the financial resources to be less burnt out than most. And so the first thing is be aware of that. Whatever you're going through, for a lot of people in your organization, it's even harder. And know that if you're stressed out, it's likely that if you're not careful, you will default to using the tactics that have served you in the past, even if they no longer serve you. So much else in the world of a pandemic you can't control. Are you trying to exert your control and get back into your comfort zone when in fact that is exactly the wrong thing to do?
We have a generation of leaders who are on the last breath of that form of control. By and large, folks who were raised by boomers, largely men with someone there to take care of their children. And they've been allowed to fixate and work was disproportionately an increasing amount of their identity. I mean, we've seen that, right? As organized marriage has gone down, participation in civic organizations has gone down, participation in organized religion has gone down. Disproportionately, their identity is tied up at work. Now, they have this little inconvenient problem of their employees not playing ball. They might want to reconsider the actual nature of their relationship with those employees. They're not servants. They're not servile. They're not there to do your whim. They're there because they have purpose. They have identity. We're not saying it's not hierarchical from a sense of work allocation, but it certainly is egalitarian when it comes to being human. We've just had a 15-month experiment on saying you can relax the controls on things like when you show up, so long as the work and the outcomes are getting done. I would start from the place of, we are all humans in a rather crazy environment trying to figure out how work fits in. And if you don't accommodate that, the employees are going to make it simple for you because they're not going to be your employee anymore.
Let me put the inflection point we're in into a historical perspective.
Great.
If you roll the clock back several centuries, the way work was done was largely agrarian. It was artisans and farmers. And it was the Industrial Revolution that changed everything about how work gets done. But what happened in the 1700s is people went from the fields to the factories. And a lot of this was ushered in by a book published in the 1770s called The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, who talked about standardization of work, division of labor. And so after the Industrial Revolution started creating enormous wealth, unheard of productivity improvements. And what you really need if you want to collaborate at that scale is you need someone to lower the transaction cost of collaboration by essentially taking on leadership and say, I will pay you a salary and you will do what you're told. That's the deal. We are going to enter into a contract, a legal employment contract, where I pay you and give you benefits and assure some level of safe work environment. And you as the worker then do as you are told. At some point, you had people working 7 days a week, 140 hours a week. And people said, that's not productive, actually. There's a production decline. There's safety issues. You had labor organize. You had even industrialists and big companies saying it's not helpful. So that's where we get the 5-day work week. That's where we get the 40 to 48 hour work week, came from the Industrial Revolution of perfecting that model. But that model's antiquated.
It's also economic. Born from an economist view of the employee, which was by and large the economic exchange. Do what you're told because I paid you.
Exactly.
It's not until you started having people asking for things like loyalty, contribution, right? You know, the extra above and beyond kind of stuff. But it's useful to point out you had 2 centuries worth of our mental model for you is a cog in a machine. And our mental model is homogenous. And it's plug and play, and you are one of many. I mean, it's no wonder you had the rise of organized labor as a disintermediator because of this, because it was faceless versus those with power. The essence, the bedrock of our system is economic exchange.
But now we're in a world where we've hit a tipping point. The tipping point is transaction costs are now low enough that you can have a gig economy. We can create technology-enabled platforms that allow us to have collaboration at scale through non-employees or quasi-employees. Now, there were some economists who said when transaction costs fall enough, when this happens, the large employed workforces will go away. That was the prediction, which I never agreed with, because there is another reason why people work for a company and have a large employed workforce, and that's the social theory of the firm. Right. It's the social relationship. But what it means is the main reason I come to work for this company A rather than company B is because of the relationships. It's because of a sense of belonging. It's because of purpose and culture and what the company stands for and a sense of shared identity and a sense of I like to be part of it.
So as we return to the office, return to work, how do business leaders kind of create that sense of identity? What are some tactical steps that they can take?
You still have to have a competitive salary. You still have to, but that's no longer enough. Before, that was sufficient. You offer people a job, you pay them a competitive wage. They think it's acceptable, and they say, "Yeah, I'll do it." And now they're saying, "Well, not enough. I want to know what you stand for. I want to know who you are. I want to know what it's like. I want to know what the culture's like. I want to know what the people are like. I want to like the people I spend time working with. I want to still have a life at home, and I want to know that you support that." I think it's time for companies to start questioning, why don't we have more flexible work options? Like, why can't somebody work 4 days a week? If they're able to deliver the same output and outcomes and results and impact 4 days a week, why do I care? What if it's 3 days a week? Why don't we have job sharing? Why don't we have half-time employment options? Yes, you can work 2 to 3 days a week, and we'll expect you, and because you're going to spend more time on whatever else you're doing. Why isn't that an option?
Right. So in this world of flexible work schedules, how can companies run productive meetings?
Some of my clients have tried out a different method where they've said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a meeting where we say it's important for everyone to be in person. And we're going to make sure everybody can be in person. Or we're going to say it's not important for everyone to be in person. And we're going to have everyone dial in or everyone be by Zoom. And so you'll say, well, yeah, but half of us are all in the same office together. Can't we just go to a conference room? No, let's try this. Let's just, I know you're in literally offices next door to each other. Just everyone, if it's not important to be in person, everyone go by Zoom. And so far, most of the companies I've talked to who have tried that have liked it. And some of them have adopted a sort of principle that says, hey, why don't we, for the most part, say, be thoughtful and intentional about, is it video conference? Is it by phone? Is it in person? But let's not have a few individuals trying to dial in remotely when everybody else is in person.
How important is it to have a test and learn culture?
I think it's very important because there's too much we don't know about the future.
Are there specific tactics?
I think there's a number. One is to encourage people to explore and try things out and not be afraid that it doesn't work perfectly. But the other is to track and measure what's working. I mean, a lot of companies, if you say, well, how is it working? Some have really good, interesting data, and some just don't have any data at all. You also want to create an environment where it's okay to share lessons about what's not working.
So places where failure is an option.
Well, I mean, look, sometimes we hear this thing about like embrace failure. Failure is good. It's like, well, no, failure. It's not that failure is good. We don't, I don't like failure. I like working with people who don't like failure. But there's a difference between not liking failure and having failure be taboo and not to be discussed and not to be shared, not to be learned from. If you never fail, you probably aren't being bold enough. You know, one of the articles I wrote recently with Amy Edmondson was about psychological safety. I was chatting with her and I'm like, how did you ever like come up with that? She had a theory that said more effective healthcare teams would have better patient outcomes. Makes sense. One measure of team effectiveness was the error rates of the team. She found an inverse correlation such that the teams that were reporting more errors had better patient outcomes. Okay, now notice what I said though. The teams that were reporting more errors were having better patient outcomes. It turns out the reason for that was the other teams were having just as many errors. They just weren't reporting them and learning from them. And thus the notion of psychological safety was born. You know, Google had this big, huge project on looking at all their teams about what's the most strong predictor of team performance. And the number one strongest predictor of team performance was psychological safety. So if you want to test and learn environment, you have to make it okay to share failure so that not only I can learn from failure, but others can learn from my failure and they don't have to make the same mistakes I made.
What are the more successful companies doing to create a sense of belonging for employees?
One of the things you can see is companies that have moved from emphasizing their mission, which is what do we do in the world, to their purpose, which is why do we do it? So engagement is not enough anymore. It used to be. It used to be engagement, yes, just go for employee engagement. I would argue that now the companies that do this well look at a much more robust, multifaceted view of the employee experience that goes beyond satisfaction and engagement.
For sure. Through most of our, let's say, the last 3.5-4 decades, we've changed our approach to developmental experiences throughout childhood. The large part was with helping kids avoid disappointment, or in many cases, avoid failure or the perception of failure. And this is not an indictment on parenting. It's just we've raised two generations of folks who believe that participation and the collective, almost the populist version of it, was the end result. It was not about winning. My point about this is I think we're seeing things in the workforce for people who value the collective just way more than the people running the place. You know, oh, it's about a clear winning. Shouldn't our mission just be killing the sneaker company that's bigger than us? Shouldn't our mission be liberating ourselves from the big bad software company? I just think it's landing flat. We should not be surprised when they say, you know, your ideas and your identity around winning just aren't enough for me. And I think that, we may end up being the better for it, but we've clearly hit a bump in the road where the people running the place are so materially missing the point. I mean, I thought the data here in this article was just remarkable at how far off the mark they were and either how little they thought of their employees or how little they understood their employees by thinking everything was transactional.
Some organizations are sending out surveys. They're doing pulse checks to see how their employees are feeling. Are these interventions useful in making the work environment feel less transactional?
When people claim about survey fatigue, no. They're not tired of you asking them your opinion. We just have to care enough to do something with it. Everywhere else in our lives, there's people tailoring things to us. Mass customization is real. And the data is all there. I mean, you know, the joke used to be Facebook knew you were having an affair before you did. You know, in terms of just looking at, you know, whose page you're going to, who you're liking, or et cetera. Your musical streaming service can see your mood based on the music that you're choosing. We have all of that data about employees.
And then tailor the experience. It's like they want more community. They want more connection. They want more flexibility. What we found is teams that have a high degree of support and psychological safety actually get a benefit from being edgy and pushing to do better. Like a hard performance edge in a team with psychological safety and support and a supportive work environment is like the best spot to be. But you put that same edge, that same kind of push in a team that doesn't have psychological safety, that doesn't have an open and supportive work environment, it has the opposite effect. It actually makes the team go into sort of this anxiety spiral.
Is there any way that we go back to some pre-pandemic period, or is this just the way that this is just the way it is now?
We're not going back to a pre-pandemic. A lot of these trends were already in place. I heard an executive say, why can't we just go back to 100% every day in the office? And I said, you mean 7 days a week? Well, no, not obviously not 7 days a week, only 5 days a week. Which days? Well, Monday through Friday, obviously. Why Monday through Friday? Well, that's just how it is. I'm like, but that's a social construct that didn't get codified until the late 1800s as a result of the Industrial Revolution. We are living in a completely different economy. Why would we default to a 40 to 48 hour, 5 day a week work week that was built in the 1700s and 1800s? Why is that the obvious answer, other than that's what you're comfortable with because that's what you grew up with? And the executive said, well, I don't know. Isn't that just how it should be? I'm like, I don't know. But now all those norms have been broken. They probably would have persisted for a lot longer beyond their usefulness just because everybody was used to it and it kept passing on from generation to generation.
Some companies are going to hear these messages and they will be determined to do it anyway. And they will find their labor cost rising, their attrition increasing, their employer brand plummeting, and they will pay more and more for people who care less and less about them and what they do. And they will have a completely mercenary workforce. And that will all be because they just had the death grip on what they thought control was. It's not going to work. It's done.
All these people are looking for something different. And if you offer that, you will attract talent like you won't believe.
Aaron and Bill, thanks for joining us today.
No, thanks you. So much. This is great. Really enjoyed it.
Speaking of talent, our next guest recently left McKinsey to pursue her PhD. But before she did, she stopped by with a great client story to share. Here's Fernanda Alcala.
The way I manage myself at work, it comes from something I started doing in my childhood. And my mother always found very curious. But whenever she gave me my plate of food, I would always start with the item I liked the least and then leave whatever I really wanted towards the end. I think that's a very similar approach to the one I apply to work. Whenever I'm trying to plan my day, and I actually appreciate very much the flexibility that McKinsey gives you, there's no strict schedule. So my mornings will always be the work that I'm dreading. And then towards the afternoon or the evening, I'll be in my happy place and doing all the work that fills my soul. I was born and I grew up in Mexico City, which is Mexico's capital. So it's a very noisy, very fast-paced, very crowded city. I grew up with that, so it's okay, it feels like home. I have been at the firm for almost 5 years. When I arrived at the firm, it was actually a very different role than the one I have right now. So the role I had was being very much in the shadows, coding models and sending back results. That changed completely. We became consultants, client facing, to be part of problem solving. There's this anecdote, and it was the first time I really felt that even though I was junior, my experience and my knowledge and my ideas were extremely valuable. It happened like this. I got staffed to a project. It was a feminine hygiene product, you know, pads, tampons, etc. Company. So I arrive to the team room on Monday and it's all men, which was interesting to say the least. All right. So I just say hi to everybody. The partner was there. Everyone was there. And then the partner asks me, do you use our client's products? And me, having absolutely no filter because I was very junior, said, no way. I would never. So I just told them, like, okay, please let me leave a little bit early today. I'm going to go to the supermarket and I'm going to buy a bunch of different things so you can actually see the product. So the next day, I just put a bunch of like different brands on the table. So when the team started opening the products, which specifically were pads, they touched them and then they started saying, oh, this feels like a little sheep and this feels like plastic. And once they were done, I just asked them, like, okay, well, imagine you need to wear that there for 5 days every month. Also, you're bleeding and it hurts. And everyone was like, well, yeah, I want the sheep, right? I don't want the plastic. And it was at that moment I told them, well, our client is the plastic. I must tell you, our client has a spectacular marketing campaign and they dominate the market. And that was a very interesting thing because the project kind of steered a little bit due to that, because then it was very marketing centric. And that day I felt, well, you know what? I'm the youngest person in the room. I'm the one that has the least work experience, but I'm actually probably the most valuable person right now because I can offer this perspective.
Thanks so much for listening to the McKinsey Podcast. I'm Lucia Raheli.
And I'm Roberta Fasaro.
Find us on McKinsey.com. We'll have a transcript of this episode up shortly.
And check out the McKinsey Insights app, where you can find this podcast and other helpful content updated daily.
And if you would, we'd love for you to leave a rating and a review.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
My stress snack food is a type of spicy gummy. It's mango flavor. And it's spicy on purpose because I know it's my stress snack. So whenever I start, it'll not get out of hand because since it's spicy, I can really only eat so much.